From the Sky News Centre at 5, another big freeze is gripping the UK. Hundreds of schools closed early and motorists are being warned off the roads. Many of the motorways are struggling with severe delays caused by commuter and holiday traffic. The RAC says at its peak it was receiving around 2,000 calls an hour. Meanwhile, the NHS blood supply is being affected by the freezing weather. John Latham from NHS Blood and Transplant says stocks are running low.
The big issue for us is O negative stock. We need more donors to come in who are particularly O neg donors, and we're making an appeal for those donors to make appointments.
The UK Border Agency will appeal against a decision preventing the deportation of a failed asylum seeker who killed a girl in a hit and run. The Prime Minister's already expressed great anger at the tribunal ruling, allowing Iraqi Aso Mohammed Ibrahim to remain here. He ran over 12-year-old Amy Houston in Blackburn in 2003 and left her dying trapped under the wheels. Criminals sentenced to 4 years or more will be automatically excluded from the right to vote when it's extended to prisoners. Judges will also be given the discretion to remove the right to cast a ballot to individuals sentenced to less than 4 years. Government caps on migrant workers have been ruled invalid by the High Court. Two judges say Home Secretary Theresa May had not given Parliament the chance to study the implications when setting the limits this summer. Our political correspondent Peter Spencer says everything seems to have been done too quickly.
Next year there will be a permanent cap, and that will be sort of legit, as it were. But what the High Court clearly ruled today was that this was rushed through in such a hurry that there wasn't proper parliamentary scrutiny, and therefore it is illegal.
Sir Paul McCartney's played one of his smallest gigs in 10 years in the tiny 100 Club in central London. Around 300 people crammed into the basement venue, renowned for hosting punk bands in the 1970s. He managed almost 30 songs in the two-hour show. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gove.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice. My first kiss went a little like
this. Mr. Jones is at home, wrapping Christmas presents. I say, Mr. Jones, are you all ready for the Yuletide festivities?
Yes, I think so.
Are you really sure, Mr. Jones? Really... really sure?
Well...
would you know who to call if you smelt gas at home? Just as I thought, Mr. Jones. You're not ready at all, are you?
Perhaps.
If you smell gas, call the National Gas Emergency Service on 0800 111 999. And remember, Mr. Jones, gas safety isn't just for Christmas, it's for life. Smell gas? Don't risk it. Call 0800 111 999. Save it to your home and mobile phone.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to Friday Drive Time, BCFM's politics show. I'm Tony Gosling, and I'm joined this week by Frankie Langland from the Socialist Party. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. Last night, Bristol's Lib Dem cabinet, this is after the 6 o'clock news, signed off the final decision to sell off, or privatise if you want, about 40 portions of Bristol's parks and open spaces. Labour councillor for St George West, Ron Stone, will be here to tell us what he thinks about Lib Dem, Gary Hopkins, Green Space, sell-off, master plan, and we hope to have Gary on the phone too. And how will the Con Dems at Westminster's cuts to universities to higher education affect disabled students? Disabled UWE student Jason Yannakopoulos is here to explain. And who really runs Bristol? Is it the City Council, business leaders, or the people that have one of the biggest financial and property portfolios in the city for centuries, the merchant venturers? That's in the second hour. So this is the final live show before the new year, because we're having a fortnight break, but that doesn't mean this slot goes quiet by any means. Next week at this time, it'll be Christmas Eve. Yes, Christmas Eve already, and we will be broadcasting two of the last talks by Forest of Dean-based TV playwright Dennis Potter. Then, on Friday fortnight, we hear a blistering attack on warmongers from a former insider at the CIA, whistleblower Philip Agee. Also, one of Bristol's least known war heroes who worked for MI6 and Bletchley Park will be telling his incredible Second World War stories on Christmas Day between 4 and 6pm. On New Year's Day, it's the turn of Yatton's chirpy former steam train driver and trade unionist Colin Force. On to our review of this week's news in a minute, but first, our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of minus 2, snow coming in around 6am on Saturday morning. That's tomorrow morning. And highs, absolute maximum of minus 1 Celsius, so the snow will be settling. Snow tomorrow then and Sunday, although slightly more on Saturday. It may get up to about 6 inches altogether. Highs of minus 2 degrees next week. The snow will be staying and doesn't look like it's going to be melting, and a fairly dry week with some sunny spells. Next weekend, that's Christmas Day and Boxing Day. Actually, I think Boxing Day is the Monday, isn't it? So that's just the 25th and 26th of December. Highs around zero, if you can call that high, and Christmas Day possibly dry and sunny, but Boxing Day looks as if it's likely to be some snow. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guest now, and with me is Frankie Langland from the Socialist Party. Hi, Frankie, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, thank you very much.
Now, first of all, can you just tell us what is the Socialist Party? Because we don't have any Socialist Party councillors in Bristol, do we?
No, we don't have any Socialist Party councillors in Bristol. The Socialist Party is a national political organisation. It used to be the Militant, which was within the Labour Party. We do have councillors. We have councillors in Coventry. We used to have a TD in Ireland, Joe Higgins, who's now an MEP representing the same area. The Socialist Party is basically an anti-capitalist organisation. We think capitalism is a disgusting system that exploits the majority of people. And we go beyond just being anti-capitalist and believe that the alternative to this is socialism, which is a fairer and more democratic system that benefits all people rather than just the rich minority.
So what about standing in the elections here in Bristol? Do we ever see Socialist Party candidates on the ballot?
We've seen Socialist Party candidates for a number of years. The last election we stood in Bristol South and Bristol East.
And what about this split with the Labour Party? Because I bet that was a little bit painful, wasn't it? So a whole bunch of people decided that they didn't want to be part of the Labour Party anymore, and to sort of, I imagine, on the left side, just split off, yeah?
We had members that were expelled from the Labour Party and others that chose to leave. I mean, in more recent years, we've had people leave because we believe that the Labour Party has effectively abandoned the working class and is more aligned with the Tory and Liberal Democrat parties. And we don't believe that the Labour Party can be saved and brought back into the working class. We think it's a ship that sailed, and we do call for a new mass workers' party, because, I mean, political representation for working class people at the moment is zero. And we do feel that there is a need for a new Labour, if you want to put it that way, but obviously not the best choice of words.
New Labour, yeah, okay. A different new Labour, maybe.
A different new Labour.
All right, so, okay, what about you personally? Well, I mean, what's your background, your work and that kind of thing, and how have you come to politics?
Well, I came into politics. I joined the Socialist Party when I was 17. I come from a working class background. I've kind of seen my mother having to struggle to bring up me and my brother, and the people around me struggling as well in the community I was brought up in, the schools that I was brought up in.
So where was that?
I'm actually originally from Suffolk, but I've moved to Bristol now. And that's just kind of drove me to look for an alternative, and kind of rough mentions of socialism in school. I don't know if that still happens, but that kind of drove me to look on the internet, actually, and I found the Socialist Party and like what I was reading. Went to meetings, which I'd encourage any of your listeners to come to if they're able to or want to. and got more active and involved, and are now branch secretary of Bristol South Branch and on the regional committee of the Socialist Party.
Okay, but what about work during the daytime?
During the daytime, I work for the NHS. I'm a healthcare assistant, frontline worker for the NHS. I'm seeing cuts already come into place, and they're saying that frontline workers will not be affected, but that is a lie.
So, can you tell us exactly what you've been seeing at work? Because this is a little bit worrying, isn't it? We discussed on this show about probably 2 months ago an announcement about a kind of privatisation of the health service. And what have you actually seen on the ground?
What I've seen on the ground is the same that the national people nationally are seeing. I mean, cuts to pay, cuts to jobs. We will eventually, I assume, see closures of units altogether. I imagine nationally the NHS will see closures of hospitals, wards, loss of beds. You say kind of privatisation, but it's not kind of, it is privatisation. It is a complete privatisation of the NHS.
So what are they actually doing? I mean, how is the structure of it changing? Because we're all very well seeing cuts and having to sort of cut back budgets, but how's the structure of the NHS been changing?
The proposed change for the GP consortiums will effectively mean private companies will be in control of the budget of the NHS, because although the GPs will be in these consortiums, they will be owned and run by private companies.
I thought they were run by trusts.
No, the foundation trusts are what's going to replace the primary care trust that we have at the moment, but they will be governed and funded and told what to do by these GP consortiums.
Okay.
And also the foundation trusts are going to be sold off to the private sector and have more influence of private the PFI to come into these to the foundation trusts.
But I mean, surely the PFI has actually been a good thing, because we've seen new hospitals being built because of the PFI.
We've seen new hospitals being built. I mean, the hospital I work in is a PFI hospital, and some of the facilities are great, but at the same time, that's driven the NHS into a lot of debt, and the amount that we will be repaying to these private businesses will be a lot more than it would have been for the NHS to build them, or the government to build them themselves.
Now, an awkward question for you, maybe a little bit unfair, but hang on a minute. Hitler was a National Socialist. The Nazi Party was the National Socialist Party of Germany.
Yeah. I think any links with fascism and socialism are completely ludicrous, to be honest. I mean, fascism is a racist... political view, and the Socialist Party and the socialists as a whole are completely against racism. We actively fight against it, and we are for equality of all people regardless of religion or race. And I don't really get that question much anymore, to be honest.
You might have got it back in the 1950s or something,
maybe,
or 40s, yeah. So I'm a bit old school. Anyway, thanks very much, Frankie. Now we're going to have a little chat to Martin. Martin, can you just tell us, Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist. Martin, you the other week were telling me how John Maynard Keynes, as an economist, was your hero. Why?
Well, he's not my only hero.
One of your many heroes.
Taking in
you've got his picture up in your hallway, have you?
Not really, no. He was very influential, to say the very least. I would say he was the most influential economist of the 20th century. And he first came to prominence. He was from a relatively wealthy background. He went to Eton, but he was a scholarship boy at Eton. But he was then drawn into the Treasury, and he ended up basically... ultimately being responsible for Britain's finances during World War One. Many of his friends, he was a man of wide sympathies. Many of his friends were opposed to the war, Virginia Woolf and people of this sort, artists, the Bloomsbury set, he was very in with them. They were all opposed to the war, and they couldn't really understand why he was working for the government. But at the end of the war, when he'd finished doing his job for the government, he wrote a very influential book, his first influential book, The Economic Consequences of the Peace, which basically argued that Germany should not be given punitive damages and reparations, that they would never pay them and it would provoke another war, in which he was proved to be right. And then when the economy crashed after 1929, he published The General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money in 1936, which basically argued that the only way to solve the problems of a slump was for the government to intervene and basically prime the pump, build infrastructure, invest in human capital, and therefore the government had a responsibility and a duty to lead the economy out of slump. He stands as a liberal activist. He stood somewhere in the middle between socialists like Frankie and myself and conservatives who don't believe in intervention of any kind in the market. But I think his ideas are extremely relevant to the situation we're in now. We're in a classic Keynesian liquidity trap. The condemns think...
What's a liquidity trap?
A liquidity trap is where people are hanging on to their money rather than spending it because they're scared of the future. And if they haven't got any money, of course, that's irrelevant to them. But the people with money are hanging on to it because they're scared of the future. Businesses won't invest, banks won't lend, people won't spend because everybody's scared. And the only way to break that is like, you know, as they do in disaster movies, you've got to slap people and make them spend their money. But you've got to actually invest. And you know, the government or the public sector actually has to take the load at this point, rather than, as we are seeing, this whole idea that the public sector has got to be cut back. Not only is it unfair and potentially damaging to people to cut back the public sector, you can't reflate the economy in this way. And I think in the new year we're going to see this very clearly, that the Keynesian view of how the economy works is far more accurate than the free market fantasy.
So why is it that the Lib Dems have sort of seemed to have shrugged their shoulders and forgotten about Keynes?
Well, we say that to them on this programme every time they come on, don't we? I think that in actual fact, many of them are unhappy about the direction of travel of their party, and so they should be, because historically, the social liberals were extremely influential in getting some of the right things done in the past. But I'm afraid Nick Clegg is not actually from that wing of the party, and he's no Lloyd George. Lloyd George was born in a cottage and had to fight his way up. Nick Clegg went to Westminster and is a millionaire.
OK, our first story today, Ireland's credit rating, on the same subject really, is cut by Moody's. First of all, Martin, maybe you could just tell us who Moody's are.
They're one of the oligopoly, or the small group of ratings agencies. These are the people that said that all of this junk that everybody was buying a few years ago was AAA. It all turned out to be rubbish. I don't know why anybody still listens to them, but they still have some influence. And what's significant about this is that Moody's and the other ratings agencies are marking down Irish debt because they are cutting. And I hope that the Condem government are watching this. They ought to be, because the cuts themselves will lead to you losing your credit rating and an increase in the deficit.
But Moody's have lowered the rate, apparently, what we're told, but by Bloomberg, from Ba1 to R2. And what does that mean?
Well, Baa1 from AAA2. I mean, it's like marking in exams. AA2 is higher than BAA1. Yeah, so you know the more A's and ones you've got in your credit rating, the better off you are. The more B's, C's, D's, and so on you've got, the worse off you are.
Frankie, what's your view about Ireland? What's been going on over there, and this story particularly about Moody's, the credit rating agency, downgrading their credit rating, basically?
I would agree that the country is still in recession because of the cuts that are being made. I mean, if you cut people's living and they're unable to go out and spend more money, which does push a country into recession. But I mean, effectively, like, the money that's been given to Ireland has not gone to the Irish people at all. It's gone straight to the banks. And I mean, there's a statistic here in this article saying that the budget shortfall will be 12% of GDP this year, or 32% including banking rescue, the government estimates, which shows that the majority of the debt that Ireland is in comes from the banks and not from the people. And there is kind of this lie that's going about that it's kind of the public sector that's driving Ireland and also Britain into debt, but this just isn't true. I mean, this debt's from the banks, and it's going to be the working people of Ireland that are paying for it.
But Frankie, if you were sitting in George Osborne's shoes, what can we do about it?
Well, I mean, I don't see why the bank should be getting this money at the loss of a working people. If I was George Osborne, then I would probably nationalise the banks, to be honest.
They've already nationalised the banks in the way they're saying
that's not really that's not nationalisation, and they're saying that's digging them out of a hole and then giving it back to them.
So, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because what's happened is, what we've done is we've invested in the banks. We've got massive shareholdings in the banks, but we're not actually controlling them, even though we could if we wanted to. At least I say we. I mean the Treasury, really.
Yeah, so that's a fair point. I mean, we own a bank. In this country, we own banks. We've saved British banks, but like you say, I mean, they're still giving themselves massive bonuses. We don't actually have any control. We don't have any voting rights, or we as normal people don't have any say in what they're doing.
Before we get off the economy, another story. Treasury rejects civil service chief's call for economic plan B. Now, I picked this one up, Martin, because I think it was 2 weeks ago you were saying there is no plan B, and it seems that Gus O'Donnell, who's the head of the civil service, thinks the same, that there needs to be a plan B.
Well, he's right. There should be a plan B. I mean, what's...
Why do we need a plan B?
Because the policy they're pursuing isn't going to work. And they've got... And if they've got any... I mean, there will... I think there will be a U-turn at some point.
So you reckon that they will have to use a plan B?
They will have to. But what will happen automatically is that government expenditure will go up as you go into a recession, depression, because you can't... government expenditure is actually quite hard to control. All of these people are entitled, for example, to unemployment benefits as they lose their jobs. Now, even if you wanted to abolish unemployment benefit, you'd have to bring a bill before Parliament, you'd have to go through the House of Lords, blah, blah, blah. It would take quite a while. Now, while that's going through Parliament, all the people who are being made redundant are entitled to claim unemployment benefit. So this is what happened in the 1980s. Massive numbers of people were pushed out of work, supposedly to save money. They all signed on, which then cost the government money. And then, oh, we're actually spending more money. Oh, we didn't mean to do that. Well, it doesn't matter whether you meant to do that or not. That will be the result. And, of course, they will need a plan B. They ought to get one, but I don't suppose that if they're not going to take any notice of Gus O'Donnell, that just shows where they're coming from.
Yeah, I think a lack of a plan B kind of shows that the condemned government are putting everything into private companies picking up the kind of demand for services and picking up jobs to fight unemployment. But that's just not going to happen. I mean, private companies are made to go for profit. They're not going to be able to provide the same sort of services that the government do. And I this isn't going to work. And I would agree that there probably will be possibly some sort of U-turn, which should be quite embarrassing to the condemned coalition, really.
Okay, on to our next story, and probably the big story of the week, which is WikiLeaks, that everyone's been talking about, the WikiLeakers. Police are probing British anonymous activists, and this is from a sort of technical, very good technical news website called The Register, and Metropolitan Police have confirmed it is investigating the activities of Anonymous, the online activism movement recently under the spotlight for its denial of service attacks in support of WikiLeaks. The probe was launched several months ago, apparently following complaints about Anonymous's attacks on the website of ACS Law, a London-based legal firm which was controversially targeting file sharers. These are people that share files on the internet, being targeted by this firm and then in turn being targeted by Anonymous, which is a sort of hacktivists collective. It also targeted BPI, the record industry trade body. Frankie, maybe you can start on this one. This is a little bit concerning, isn't it, that we've got sort of wars going on the internet with various people trying to take down other people's websites. Do you think that this group Anonymous is justified in what it's trying to do here?
I think it's kind of an angry response to what WikiLeaks have released. I mean...
Well, it's a response to the way that WikiLeaks was taken down.
Yeah, exactly.
WikiLeaks was taken off the internet, and it's had to sort of struggle to get service providers. And this this group, Anonymous, seems to be responding to various things.
I mean, it's quite interesting, kind of the turn of protests, really, and how they're kind of being cyber-based. I think that's it's a fair attack if they're kind of attacking WikiLeaks, which I think...
But it's a law firm, for goodness sake. I mean, so all that's happened is someone's gone to this law firm, asked them to do some work for them, and why should the law firm's website then be taken out?
Guilt for association, I guess, isn't it? It is just another form of protest. I mean, it's the same what we see in the streets of Bristol, like people trying to attack like Vodafone shops or Arcadia shops because they're not paying their taxes. I mean, that's kind of what we're seeing here, but in a cyber and kind of a virtual form.
But where's it going to end? Because I mean, you would have thought that the American government, if it's we're talking about WikiLeaks or other people, you know, is there going to be end up with nothing left on the internet? Everyone has been taken down.
Well, yeah, I mean, the question about where do we stop off, where are we making where are we stopping what people can put up on the internet, and I think I mean I think that is kind of a democratic right that you do kind of have. I mean, the internet's played a massive role in the student process as well, like Facebook and Twitter, and police have been spying on those resources.
Yeah, but Facebook have quite famously refused to take down the site. They've got a special sort of site for WikiLeaks on Facebook that the American government asked them to take down. They refused.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair enough. I mean, people have a right to freedom of speech. I mean, I think like the whole attack on the WikiLeaks is quite disgraceful, to be honest, in a way. I mean, Britain and America are kind of going into other countries showing people what democracy should be like.
What's the point of having something like the Official Secrets Act if these governments can't act on those laws?
Official Secrets Act? Well, I mean, they're lying to the people who they're representing. I mean, I think you kind of forget that. I mean, these people are elected by us, and I mean, some of these lies, I mean, they're cover-ups of appalling atrocities in Iraq and Afghanistan, corruption and bribery by these governments, and I mean, they're just lying to people that are voting for them. And I think there probably wasn't that much surprise when these stories came out from people. I think people like actually thought this, like, governments are dodgy and governments are doing things like that. I mean, I don't think there was really that much shock.
But Martin, we're going to be bringing you in here. What's your thoughts about this group Anonymous and their attempts to bring down these legal websites, and now they're being investigated by the police?
Yeah, I mean, just picking up on what Frankie was saying about attacks on the Vodafone, I think protests inside shops are not attacks on those shops in a physical sense, are they?
No.
They're absolutely legitimate protest tactics. This kind of protest tactic is a response to the state's heavy-handed response to what WikiLeaks represents. But what worries me about all of this is that this is all a kind of game manipulating public opinion for full-on censorship of the internet and prevention of a proper debate on the internet. We know that in China, for example, there are very big restrictions on what websites you can and can't see, and we know that there are people in the US who are quite keen to see similar restrictions on what we can and can't see. And I think there is suspicions out there in cyberland that WikiLeaks is being set up to be the straw that breaks the camel's back that allows all of these repressive measures to be brought in.
How likely do you think that is?
Well, I'm not technical enough to know, but I understand from people who are more techie than me that it's actually quite difficult to suppress these things ultimately, and that governments basically might want to, but they can't. They find it quite difficult. What they really rely on is that the mainstream media still sets the terms for most debates. So they rely basically that most people haven't got the time. I mean, these WikiLeaks documents are literally massive, huge amounts of documents, and most people haven't got the time to go through them. So they do rely upon others to do that for them. And you know, that the mainstream media then spins what's in there to suit the agendas that they've already got.
But it is a bit bemusing dealing with WikiLeaks, isn't it? Because there's just so many thousands and thousands of leaks all the time. Where do you find something that's actually relevant?
What happens then? Somebody helpfully points out the things that you should be picking up on. Oh, like the Iranians are trying to get nuclear weapons. Don't forget, a lot of this is just gossip by the American State Department with other people in the American State Department. People telling their bosses what they think they want to hear, and then this is leaked into the media as if we all know that the Iranians are trying to get nuclear weapons because that's what the Americans have been talking about in private amongst themselves. But that's just the Americans' delusion. And then it's being treated as if it's some kind of revelation, you know.
One story about WikiLeaks, rather than actually a leak itself, comes from Al Hakika, which is an Arab internet news service, investigative service. Now, I do wonder if it's HAQ, is anything to do with hacking. But anyway, Al Hakika tells us, and this is a report actually off of the San Francisco Indy Media website, that WikiLeaks struck a deal with Israel over diplomatic cable leaks, and they cite the evidence that in August 2006, when the invasion of Lebanon took place, there's a big gap in the leaked cables. Now, let's not forget that WikiLeaks cables started in 2000. These particular cable leaks started in 1966 and have gone all the way up to the present day.
1966.
Sorry?
1966.
1966, the first cables were leaked by WikiLeaks. And then we've got right the way through to the present day, we've got this gap in August 2006. And this is what Al Hakika is saying, is that a deal, it looks like, was done in Geneva between Julian Assange and some Israelis. So it may possibly be that this is how WikiLeaks are making a bit of their money is by saying to various governments, look, if you can pay us, we'll not leak stuff. Now, do you want to start on this one, Frankie? Is that feasible, do you think?
I mean, I don't know if it's true or not, but certainly if it is, it kind of would defy the point of what WikiLeaks claims to be standing for, really. I mean, it's kind of just it's releasing information regardless of like their own political beliefs or understandings. They're just kind of giving information out that they've got. So, I mean, I if that is true, then I mean that would probably be quite a shock to a lot of people who are supporting WikiLeaks.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I was the one who drew your attention to the story, if you remember, Tony, originally. I think what may be happening, see, WikiLeaks doesn't seem to be functioning like a completely rebellious organisation.
Why not?
But no, they've approached various mainstream newspapers to put their stuff out, and various people who've worked with Assange said that he doesn't negotiate, you know, he basically is secretive himself, so the people he's working with, he doesn't tell them what he's doing or what deals he's making.
Well, I know a lot of the volunteers that work at WikiLeaks have actually decided that they don't want to work with him anymore.
There's another question. I mean, Assange is in favour of transparency. Well, we need to know where WikiLeaks funds come from. We really do. And if some of them come from Israel, then we need to know, don't we?
Okay, another story. Berkeley, that's in California, the city council, tables a resolution to call suspected WikiLeaks soldier a hero. And this is about is it Bradley Manning? Yes, Bradley Manning is accused of releasing the documents originally to WikiLeaks, these cables. And there's a vote in Berkeley, at Berkeley City Council, over whether he should be called a hero and obviously gotten out of prison. At least they're discussing it in Berkeley. What do you think about this character, Bradley Manning, Frankie?
I mean, I haven't really heard much of this story, to be honest. So,
well, he hasn't actually been on trial, and it's not been proven that it was actually him that did these leaks, but he is in jail at the moment in the US, and his family are being told he's going to be in there for at least 18 months. Martin?
He's sorry.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're still only seeing the tip of the iceberg with all of this story, aren't we? I mean, if Bradley Manning did leak all these files, maybe he is a hero. Perhaps some of the files didn't come from him. This is a suspicion. I mean, we've seen the Pakistanis accused of uploading false WikiLeaks last week in The Guardian. I mean, we're now in a kind of information war where all sorts of rumours are swirling around. I mean, we've certainly learned an awful lot about the day-to-day hypocrisy of our politicians. I mean, but as Frankie said earlier, that's not really that much of a surprise to those who are paying attention. I think we've just got to keep our eye on all of these things and be very, very cautious about jumping to judgment about what's actually happening. I think it's not that, you know, Berkeley is probably the most radical local area in the United States. So, you know, in mid-United States, they'll be passing resolutions to have him hung, drawn and quartered. I think basically we deserve to know what he's told us. So in many ways, if he did leak these leaks, then he is a hero.
Well, it's just gone 5:30 now, and you're listening to Friday Drive Time on BCFM 93.2. This is the final live show before the new year, because we're having a fortnight break, but that doesn't mean this slot goes quiet. Next week this time, it will be Christmas Eve. We'll be broadcasting two of the final talks by Forest of Dean-based TV playwright Dennis Potter. Then on Friday fortnight, a blistering attack on warmongers from a former CIA insider, Philip Agee. On the Friday Drive Time webpage, you can listen to all previous shows over the last 18 months. That's at www.thisweek.org.uk. And you can email me anytime at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Now, Marina Morris has been braving the bitter temperatures this week to find out what you think about socialism. Is socialism dead in Britain?
Is socialism dead in Britain? And what does it mean to you?
No, I don't think it's dead. I think there will always be an element of socialism. And the question is how popular it is. And I think at the moment it's certainly underground. My personal view is that it, like all cycles in politics, that it will eventually resurface. What does it mean? It means left wing, more involvement by the power to the, you know, for the people, for the everyday man, rather and a greater involvement by the government in affairs, as opposed to conservatism, which is, you know, leave to do, less involvement. Yeah, it's a greater this sort of mass ownership by the public?
No, not quite. Why not? Oh, because there's still people who believe in putting people first rather than the interests of money. Whether that's right or not is another matter. Well, I'm not a great believer in it myself, so not very much.
Well, is the Socialist Party going to get elected? Probably not. But, I mean, there's loads of youth sort of interest in it, but is it going to come to anything? I don't know. Just general left-wing sort of politics, you know, about equality and sharing out the resources among everyone.
I guess, it's because it has changed, different. It's not what it was initially to be as they conceived, but now it's different. It's more modern, more capital. Let's go going into the capital. It's more materialistic.
Well, to me it is, yeah. I don't hear too much about it. Power to the people, I suppose.
I don't think it is dead, but socially, people must be more friendly, more outgoing, more approachable. Yeah, that's what I think socialism means, so.
It's not dead in Britain because there's, well, the NHS is a socialist thing, healthcare is social, there's still social housing. I think there's aspects of socialism in Britain. Obviously not a completely socialist country, but there are aspects of it still in play.
Will the big society address social issues and needs?
I am not really sure, actually. I think it's a good idea, and I think it's a good experiment. Whether it will or not, I think will remain to be seen. I'm really not sure. But if it, you know, it's a great idea. If it does work, then great. But no doubt that if it doesn't, then there'll be a change of government and, you know, the next government will have an opportunity to put their plan into place.
It will attempt to, yes. Whether it succeeds is another matter.
I think that's the idea that we've got to take responsibility is a good one, and that you can't rely on politicians to do everything for us at the end of the day. Some of the footwork's got to come from us now.
It has to address the social issues. Otherwise, there could be a problem, I think.
I don't think he will, no. He hasn't. He's promised loads of things and he hasn't kept his promises, like college funds, he's cut that. When he said he wouldn't, I don't think he would do it, no.
Well, I think to an extent Big Society does. For all the things I mentioned before, there is an NHS and there is a social housing system. Unfortunately, obviously, he can't help everyone, but that's unfortunate.
Can we afford socialism?
I don't think we can at the moment, no, because of the credit problems and the bank bailouts, etc. I think it's a very costly system. It requires everything working in, to equilibrium. It just isn't at the moment. So maybe over time it will. But even then, I'm not so sure. Maybe it's a theory rather than something that can work in practice.
Well, I'm not sure we can afford anything at the moment with all these cutbacks and reductions in public spending. So I would say, depending on what socialism is, possibly not.
Can we afford it? Well, there are other countries that, have socialist governments that work well, don't they? Like Sweden and other countries. It's just a case of, if you're going to do it, then do it properly. Don't do, at the moment, we're neither socialist nor are we right wing. So you kind of get the worst of both worlds. If you're going to be socialist, then do it properly.
Well, it's difficult. I would say it's very expensive. Yes, that would be my answer.
Yes, I think so, yeah. They're cutting loads of things and I don't think it needs to be cut, and I think they could afford socialism.
Yeah, of course you can afford certain aspects of socialism. There's no way they'd ever get rid of the NHS. It would be wrong. You need certain aspects of socialism to be free almost.
That was Marina Morris's report, Vox Pop, talking to you out on the streets of Bristol earlier this week with your views on socialism and is it dead? Now I'm joined by Frankie Langland from the Socialist Party. Frankie, we heard all sorts of things there, particularly, I mean, obviously, as you're an NHS worker yourself, people saying that actually we can't live without the NHS, but you're telling us that it looks like we might have to.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely what the Tories have in plan, is to get rid of the NHS. I mean, I think maybe people's understanding of what socialism is might have been a bit mixed there. I mean, obviously, having nationalised healthcare, social housing and other things like that is definitely what socialism is a part of, but it goes beyond that. I mean, it is like the whole of society is owned by the people who live in that society.
But actually, it isn't, is it? In our system, it isn't actually owned by the people that live in it. It's owned by the people that actually own the property, mostly.
Kind of buildings and things have been sold off to private companies in that respect. But I mean, the taxes we pay are going into those, into things like the NHS, childcare in some parts of the country, housing, benefits.
But I mean, in a slump or recession, the sort of thing we're seeing at the moment, the tax receipts the government gets are going down and down and down. Surely what some of the people were saying there is we just simply can't afford socialism.
Well, we can't afford, under capitalism, maybe what's being led by the Tory government we can afford, but socialism doesn't take place immediately out of capitalism. I mean, it would need a complete transformation of society. I mean, a revolution is what I think we would need.
Well, what do you mean by a revolution exactly?
A revolution is a complete change of society or anything. So, I mean, probably I would look to what we saw at the Russian Revolution. I mean, I'm not saying that I would want kind of a bloody war, really. I mean, I don't want that at all. It would be brilliant if we could transform society peacefully. But I think kind of capitalism is something that is so clung onto by capitalists, the bourgeois, that they wouldn't let it go peacefully, and they would fight.
We hear this term, the bourgeois, quite a lot. What does that actually mean?
The ruling class.
But surely we don't live in a country which is just controlled by the ruling class. We live in a democracy. We vote in the people we want to run our affairs.
Yeah, but I mean, if you look at the cabinet, the Tory cabinet at the moment, the majority of those are millionaires. I mean, we've had an enormous amount of...
Yeah, but they were voted in democratically, weren't they?
Yeah, they were voted in, but how did you get to that position where you get voted in the first place? I mean, I don't think I could walk into the Tory party, regardless, if I wasn't a socialist, obviously, and say, I want to be the next Prime Minister and work my way up.
Well, maybe you could walk into the Labour Party and do that.
I mean, I think it goes beyond the control of government. I mean, if we look at the business owners, like the people who have the say in government, the people who are donating money to the political parties, that's where the money's coming from. I mean, it's coming from big business, and those aren't the majority of people. They're not represented by people like Virgin Media, like BP, like Shell. They're the very, very rich minority.
So you think that the political parties are more interested in the people who are donating money to them than in the voters?
Definitely. I mean, there was... there was kind of a thing saying that people shouldn't, organisations shouldn't be able to donate to parties. But at the end of the day, I think like Labour and the Tories and the Lib Dems, they should be more than willing to accept donations from those businesses, because they're the people they represent. So why shouldn't they be funded by them?
So socialism being the topic, I think when people say we can't afford socialism in a situation like this, I just think that we've got to break this negative psychology. It's because capitalism's failed that we need socialist solutions. And
would you say a whole socialist state?
Well, as Frankie said, it's a process. It doesn't happen overnight. It's a process of social.
Well, she was saying a revolution, which might happen overnight.
Well, I mean, revolution's a very emotive word, and it can mean different things in different contexts, can't it? I think in the past people have had a very kind of stilted view of what revolution was, often based on past history, because revolutions tended to be, you know, bloody events with lots of conflict and so on. But I think most of the people responding to the Vox Pops were thinking of socialism in the British sense of the word, which is basically the kind of steps that were taken in the middle of the last century to humanise capitalism, which led beyond socialism, beyond capitalism. And of course, at a certain point, that wave receded and capitalism got the upper hand and started to push back the socialist gains that we'd made, including the NHS. Mm. And of course, this is an eternal struggle, and it's going to be an eternal struggle until capitalism dies. But the good news is capitalism is dead. The bad news is capitalism is dead.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, if we look at kind of the welfare reforms that were made after the Second World War, I mean, we can have reforms in capitalism, but I think, like was just being said, these are taken away from us under capitalism. So, like, students are going out fighting for tuition fees. We'll probably, when the NHS is under attack, we'll go out and fight for the NHS. But, I mean, for how many years is that going to be safe for us? How many more years are we going to be able to keep these gains that we've made? I mean, ultimately, that's why we need socialism, because capitalism is constantly going to take back from us what the working class have managed to get.
Okay, on to our next story. Condemn cuts mean 200,000 more children will be forced into poverty. That's a headline in the Daily Mirror. And a scathing verdict on Chancellor George Osborne's economic policy. The study said that child poverty would rise for the next 3 years. The report by the respected Institute for Fiscal Studies also warns that poverty among adults would leap by 700,000. So that's what, 200,000 children and 700,000 adults apparently are going to be moving into official, what is officially known as, I don't know how they work these things out, but
this is
poverty.
Extra poverty.
So, Martin, do you want to comment on this story?
Well, I mean, it just completes everything we've just been saying, doesn't it, really? I mean, this is where the shoe pinches. This is where the policies really impact on people. And, of course, what they're relying on is that once you've pushed people into poverty and alienation and they're struggling just to get by on a daily basis, they often lose interest in politics. And this is the strategy behind what's being done. It's a shock and awe strategy. So we would like to think that as people get pushed into the floor, they will rebel. But what they are hoping is that they will be crushed. And that is the policy. They hope that capitalism will somehow reinvent itself on the backs of these, of the people's misery. Now, in actual fact, it won't work from everything we've been saying earlier. The real problem for them is that capitalism, the financial capitalism, is basically dead on its feet. They're making loads of false profits at the moment, which are not real profits. They can't make the system work, but most people are still stuck in a rut and thinking in past terms that they think that somehow we're going back to normal, i.e. normal capitalism. We're not.
Shadow Work and Pensions Secretary Douglas Alexander said it flatly contradicts David Cameron's promise that there would be no increase in child poverty. Frankie?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, George Osborne said that we're all in this together, and I think statistics like this just prove how wrong he is. The fact that an extra 200,000 children and 700,000 adults are going to be in poverty because of the cuts that he's putting through is absolutely disgusting. I mean, these cuts aren't just kind of people having to like miss a night out or not be able to buy nice clothes and things. I mean, this is a life and death situation, which will be another article that we can discuss later.
We've got also another two stories now. One is about one in four courts in Britain to close. We've been told this week that the magistrates' courts in Frome, Bridgewater, Coleford, Cirencester and Lyndhurst are to close, and the county courts in Cheltenham and Trowbridge, those are the only ones fairly local to Bristol, are going to close. And also, there's safety fears over the cuts to the Coast Guard. The government has slashed the number of 24-hour Coast Guard stations from 18 down to 3, sparking fears about safety around the UK's coast. So, Martin, what about closing the courts and closing the Coast Guard stations?
Well, I mean, basically, this is running down the infrastructure. Now, I mean, the debate by the mainstream media is presented as, we have to cut, what are we going to cut? And we might argue that we should cut the war in Afghanistan as opposed to cutting these things that we value. But what we've really got to do is change the mentality. The only way to get out of this recession depression is not to cut, it's to invest in the future.
But I'm going to change
people and infrastructure.
I'm going to change your mentality, Martin. We can't afford it.
We can afford it because you can run deficits, as we know. We are running them. The US is running the biggest deficit of all and has been for donkey's years, the supreme capitalist society. And, of course, ultimately, things do have to be paid for. And what we've had in the last 30 years is a bourgeois class, as Frankie called them earlier, who have actually got, they've improved their wealth enormously. Because of the so-called reformed capitalist reforms they brought in from the 1980s onwards, the wealthy top 5% of British society have become fantastically more wealthy than they ever were before. They were already minted. They're now minted in spades. And when people say there's no money, I say, phooey, there's plenty of money. They've got it. They must give it up. It's a national emergency. They say so themselves. National emergency, like 1940. And that means you must get your chequebooks out. That is all.
Frankie, what are your thoughts about cuts? So we've got here magistrates' courts, one in four courts across the country closing, many of the Coast Guard stations. Yeah. We've also got the Harrier jump jets. They're being cut. No more of those taking off. That would probably do a lot of good for global warming. And also, the Forensic Science Service is to be wound up.
Yeah, I mean, it just kind of shows how everything is actually under attack, really. Nothing's safe. I mean, the first story about the 200,000 children forced into poverty and obviously cuts to benefits and that kind of shows indirect cuts that are putting people's lives at risk. But I mean, the Coast Guard, I mean, are directly putting people's lives at risk. And I mean, Bob Crowe, there's a quote here from Bob Crowe, who's the General Secretary of RMT, saying that about the condemned government.
That's the union that represents Coast Guard workers.
Yes, yeah, that's it, sorry. Are quite prepared to hack away at life or death services. These proposals must be fought tooth and nail every step of the way, and obviously I'd agree with him in that. The cuts to the courts, again, a loss of public sector jobs. And also, I mean, I know this isn't in the article, but just about legal aid as well. I mean, these cuts to the democratic process of justice that people keep that obviously people hold quite important. I find quite important. I mean, legal aid as well. I mean, that's basically saying you can only defend yourself if you're well enough to do so.
What about this? The Harrier jump jets. I wonder, are you really glad to see there's no more Harrier jump jets, or do you think that this is a bit of a silly thing to cut, Frankie?
Definitely not. I mean, there's a lot of charities that are kind of funding the armed services at the moment. I think that's absolutely disgusting that our government can't even give our troops kind of enough money to kind of do the job that they've been forced into. I mean, just again, it just shows that everything is under attack. There's nothing sacred.
Martin, we're told constantly we're living in a really dangerous world. So why Harrier jump jets? What, I mean, this is a sort of naval air projection.
Don't forget that the Harrier jump jets are pretty old technology these days. And frankly, we really do have to have a good look at our military posture. Because the defence spending in the US particularly has not been in any way affected by cuts. It's actually been expanded. And if you actually think about what British military requirements really are for our national defence, what we probably need is a crack British Army peacekeeping force. And for that, we don't need lots of fancy electronic equipment. We need well-trained frontline soldiers with proper basic equipment. A lot cheaper than the posture we've got at the moment, where for the third time we're trying to conquer Afghanistan. I thought we'd grown out of all of that, but apparently we haven't.
So you're saying that you don't think that we would need to use jets in the future, naval-based jets?
No, I mean, if you think about all of the Royal Navy, it was really basically being kept as a sort of a counter, you know, the Red Navy in the North Sea, and that's no longer a real threat. I mean, frankly, we've don't forget that money spent on things like the war in Afghanistan doesn't do anything to help people back in Britain. It is just lost money.
No, what we're told, of course, is that actually what they're doing is they're closing down terror training camps.
Well, that's another question altogether, isn't it? These are questions about the posture, the war on terror. These aren't purely economic questions; they're also political questions.
And the other thing is, of course, that all these services we've just been talking about—so many that were even just in this week in the news—we've been told are going to be cut. What's the point in paying your tax if you're not actually getting a lot for all the various different services like the courts, etc., are being closed down?
No, definitely. I mean, people have been asked to pay more money for a service that they're a lesser service, basically.
Well, VAT being increased to 20%, which crushes small businesses.
Why does VAT increases crush small businesses?
Because it's basically a tax on retail. Huh? Now, the fact is that George Osborne this week was saying that there's never going to be that will be the rate of VAT going forward. Now, what they're doing is they're shifting the tax burden from themselves. Corporation tax is going to be cut, but VAT is going to go up. So big business is going to have its taxes cut, small business is going to have its taxes increased. Now, this is all desperately unfair, as we've been explaining, but it's more than that, it's desperately irrational. People on small incomes spend the money they get. People on large incomes do not. And we need
they can't
talking
spend
about? All of their money.
Martin, what are you talking about? They buy expensive cars, they buy yachts and things like that.
What they do with the vast majority of the money they get is reinvested in even more speculative activities. It's not actually productive in any real sense of the word. The only way out of the recession depression is actually to invest in people and infrastructure. So cutting people and infrastructure is not only unfair, it will also fail. And it's going to fail spectacularly. By the middle of next year, even the dumbest person in Britain is going to realise that the people in charge don't know what they're doing. The people in Ireland have already drawn that conclusion about their government. They are right, and the people in Britain will be right.
So, Frankie, in a nutshell, what's the economic policy, and what would you be doing, as a Socialist Party person, Socialist Party candidate, or even an MP or minister or whatever?
Well, as a Socialist Party candidate, we would stand on the platform of no cuts. I think there's enough wealth in this country to provide, not only to keep the services we have, but to actually improve them and make them much better. And also, the Socialist Party is affiliated to the Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance, which is an organisation in Bristol, across the country, who are fighting all these cuts actively. And if we were to stand for election, then we would stand on that same platform.
But ultimately, of course, the Anti-Cuts Alliance doesn't hold the purse strings, does it? What can the Anti-Cuts Alliance actually do?
Oh, well, the people hold the purse strings. I mean, we're the ones that own these services. We're the ones that should have control over them. And I think we are going to see demonstrations. I mean, like, sorry to keep going on about the student demonstrations, but I mean, the idea of that happening this time last year, maybe even a few months ago, is completely, I don't know if I'd believe it. I mean, there were demonstrations every day almost for 3 weeks, and there's a lot of anger over that issue. There's a lot of anger from school students, and there's going to be a lot of anger if cuts are made to the NHS. All these things haven't actually been put into place yet, but when they do, we're going to see a fight back of people of Bristol, of people of Britain.
When you say a fight back, what do you mean? You mean sort of getting physically, having a ruck with the police, or what?
Well, I mean, I don't think people go, or maybe some people go into demonstrations to have a fight with the police. Majority of people don't know. I think there is anger, though. I mean, we shouldn't kind of say it's not. People are angry about this, because these are people's lives. I mean, it's not like they're taking away something superficial from us. I mean, this is going to affect everyone's day-to-day life. It's going to affect people's children. And I think it is a powerful issue, and people do feel strongly about it, and I think maybe the Conservatives are kind of underestimating that.
What they're also underestimating is that the cuts will actually make the deficit worse. That's what we've seen in Ireland. Come February, March next year, it's going to be obvious that the deficit is actually getting worse. And at that point, the intellectual justification for the policy will disintegrate like snow in spring. And once people realise that the pain is for no gain, then I think they're just going to be on the ropes very quickly.
Definitely. I mean, I think, like, the idea that that this is kind of a necessity is completely wrong. I mean, the Tories are doing this because that's what they want politically. It's the political ideal that is driving these cuts, not necessity.
But not economic literacy, though. That's one of their problems.
Okay, on to, I mean, you've said that how many times, Martin? I don't know now. Barbara is our Boris. That's the next story, local story here. City Council leader Barbara Jenk from the Evening Post will become Bristol's answer to London Mayor Boris Johnson next year under coalition plans to be unveiled in Parliament today. The Liberal Democrat councillor Barbara Jenk will automatically be given the prestigious figurehead position as part of a widespread package of reforms to devolve power announced by the government. Community Secretary Eric Pickles has placed 12 areas he wants to give a strong and powerful executive mayor to help drive local economic growth and enhance the prestige of major cities like ours, just as Boris Johnson has done in London. Now, is this something you welcome, Frankie?
I definitely would be more in favour of a more democratic Bristol City Council. But I think, firstly, if we were to elect a mayor of Bristol, we'd have the choice, again, between the three main parties, Lib Dems, Labour, Conservatives. And I don't think that's a democratic choice. I think that's people voting for one of the same. And also, I think, like, if we look at kind of the Bristol green space issue that's been brought up, that was obviously voted on last night.
Which we'll be talking about after six. It's fine.
Elected councils that we have at the moment aren't actually listening to us. I mean, there was thousands of letters, petitions and freedom of information requests that went missing. I think it was like over 16,000 people that signed petitions against that. So, I mean, what's to say that this mayor of Bristol is going to pay any more attention than the already elected members of that council?
I think there's a potential danger in this. I mean, Ken Livingstone was the elected mayor of London at one stage, but he always said that the role of an elected mayor was not really his ideal setup. And we've had councillors on here many a time saying that the existing setup is too narrow. A cabinet system means that only a small group of people ever get to make decisions. If we have an elected mayor, what's the point of having any other councillors? Because the elected mayor either overrules the rest of the council or has to submit to what the rest of the council wants. I think it's a concentration of power, and what we need is more diversity of voices on the council, not just one person, the Führer Prinzip of having just one person making all the decisions.
Hang on a minute. You're not saying that Barbara Jenk is going to be like a Führer, are you?
No, I don't suppose, and I suspect that Barbara Jenk would not necessarily support this either.
So
we're going to have this imposed on us by central government in order to give us more local voice.
Okay. Now, of course, there was a big reorganisation about 5-6 years ago, wasn't there, where where the cabinet system was brought in. Mm. This seems to me to be maybe a sort of enhancement of that, a further step in that direction. And most of the councillors, I mean, you know, we've got something like, isn't it, 80, 70 councillors in the city that have been on here have said they don't like the system because actually it's less democratic. And this parks sell-off thing has been decided by the Liberal Democrat cabinet, really, rather than the full council. Yeah.
What you also find when you have elected mayors is you get celebrity candidates. Esther Ranson for mayor, anybody? Yeah, and we had that chap that dressed in a monkey costume and got elected for mayor, who's now being prosecuted, I believe, for malfeasance. It's more X Factor politics. That's what's this is what's problematic about this. If you look at elected mayors in the US, like Mayor Daley, who used to run Chicago for 30 years, it was corrupt as hell. Is that what we want?
Well, we're coming up now to the Sky News at 6, thanks to this week's guest, Frankie Langland from the Socialist Party. After the news, well, last night Bristol's Lib Dem cabinet signed off the final decision to sell off, or privatise, if you like, 40 portions of Bristol's parks and open spaces. Labour councillor for St George West, Ron Stone, will be here in a minute to tell us what he thinks. And also, we hope to have on the line too Lib Dems' Gary Hopkins. And will the Con Dems at Westminster's cuts to universities affect disabled students? Disabled UWE student Jason Yannakopoulos will be here to explain. And also, who really runs Bristol? Is it the City Council, business leaders, or the people who have one of the biggest financial and property portfolios in the city, the merchant venturers? That's in the second hour, so join us after the news.
You are listening on BCFM 93.2 FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody